This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, and get the one talk. Ndi san bolivinaka and good fellow morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Iakwe, ita in egitupo, and hope your weekend went well. It is a brand new week, and on the show for your Monday, is it possible to improve the aviation situation in Vanuatu? Samoa's politics may have calmed down, but their journalists have been a subject to attack on social media. And in a moment, we'll cross to Fiji to get the latest on Linda Tabuya's future. It's unclear as to whether her role as an MP will continue. Stay tuned for all these stories and more, but before we begin, we give acknowledgement to the traditional owners and custodians of the lands of which our show comes to you, from the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Ko mol tata. Thank you for tuning in to Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, in late December, Fiji's Minister for Women, Social Welfare and Child Protection, Linda Tabuya, was dismissed and removed from Cabinet after a private explicit video was circulated online. Tabuya's future remains unclear as to whether her role as an MP will continue with the People's Alliance Party. So joining me this morning to discuss the latest developments is senior multimedia journalist at the Fijian Broadcasting Corporation, Kuritika Kuma. With that I say, Bula Kuritika, and welcome to the show.
Bula Egi, good morning and warm Pacific greetings from the beautiful island of Fiji, and thank you so much for having me on your show.
Yes, appreciate your time this morning, Kuritika. Look, as we get into this, according to the Constitution, the Disciplinary Committee had about 21 days, right, to do their work and report back to the party. Have they been able to report back?
So according to Prime Minister Sitiveni Rambuka, the disciplinary committee, they had completed their work. However, they could not get the quorum to sign their written report at the allocated time, and they had sought an extension for that.
So with that extension, how long are we seeing until something can be reported back?
So the extension was until last week Friday, and the executive committee meeting and the management committee were supposed to meet on Friday. However, there was no confirmation about the meeting, but there were indications that Linda Tabuya might remain as a member of parliament.
Okay. Yes, I was just going to ask whether or not then had a decision been made by the party itself, by People's Alliance Party, whether she would stay or go. So right now, it's still unconfirmed, right?
Yes, it's still unconfirmed, and according to the sources, the meeting is supposed to convene either today or tomorrow to confirm all those discussions and the outcomes of the report from the disciplinary committee.
Kuritika, has Linda Tabuya herself made any public comments about her membership?
No, since she was removed from cabinet, she hasn't come out in public, or she hasn't been out and about in terms of visiting events and other stuff. But she has been actively posting on her social media site, but nothing to do with government, rather just in terms of the rugby games and all those things. But she hasn't come out openly to talk about the video that was circulated.
And we do understand the Prime Minister himself, had removed her from her MP role, but from her ministry role. But has he been able to comment any further on this situation?
No, the last comment that we got from him last week was just in terms of the quorum not getting enough quorum to sign their written report. And also he had confirmed that there was extension given to the committee to complete their work.
Kuritika, when we look at how this can affect not just the government itself, but even just the public, what has the public reaction been to the credibility now of Tabuya's leadership?
So there were a lot of concerns that were being raised by Fijians after that video got leaked, because given she was Minister for Women, Children and Social Protection, and she was one of the members on our pornography task force as well. So there was a credibility issue that people had raised in terms of her talking about the pornography task force and having an explicit video that was circulating on social media. So that kind of contradicted whatever she was trying to work towards. So that was one of the concerns that Fijians raised, and those were some of the concerns which prompted Prime Minister to take the action of removing her from cabinet.
Kutika, are we aware at any point where Tabuya is still trying to clear her name in regards to everything that's been happening?
I think she is waiting for the disciplinary committee to complete her work, and then she might be coming open into the media and talking to media about some of the things that had led to the circumstances that had led to the incidents and all those things.
Okay, I want to switch to another situation that happened recently. While I have you, there was another video that went viral online showing a disgruntled passenger travelling on Fiji Airways. Wondering whether or not you could probably give us any more details as to what actually happened and why.
So, yes, that is one video that made headlines last week, and it showed a 69-year-old Australian, Stephanie Banks, who was allegedly misbehaving on Fiji Airways flight that was from San Francisco to Nandi, FJ871. So she was apparently, she was charged under the Fiji's Civil Aviation Act for unruly passenger behavior, and she was produced in Nandi Magistrates Court last week.
Wow. Do we know whether or not she was under the influence of anything, drugs, alcohol?
So apparently, claims have been made that she was intoxicated and she was misbehaving with the Fiji Airways flight crew members.
And I do understand that there was a point there where they had to use, was it tape?
Yes, they had to use the tape to keep her quiet. And then upon landing at Nandi Airport, they had called authorities and she was taken into custody. And after that, on Thursday, she was produced in court. And the Nandi Magistrate Court had demanded her to pay a $500 fine.
Wow. I'm wondering, has Fiji Airways said anything about the video and whether or not tape is some sort of form of restraint that this is used on airlines?
So that's one of the concerns that we had raised with Fiji Airways. However, we haven't received any confirmation yet. But they had also they tried not to use force that much because I think they are well trained to deal with those kinds of issues. And other than that, so she was released on bail for $1,000 and a stop departure was issued against her as well.
Wow. Look, it's been a tough past month for the tourism industry. You know, we have this video. Before that, we had the Virgin Air crew assault and then the poisoning at the Warwick Hotel. I mean, how has the tourism industry itself said anything?
The tourism minister had reassured about the safety of tourists in Fiji after the Virgin Australia crew members were allegedly assaulted and virtually raped. So after that, the minister, Mr. Minister William Ngavoka, had held a press conference and he had assured tourists about the safety. And also he had asked the police to increase their presence in the areas that are well known or well populated areas where people are going for dinner and party and all those things. So one of that was Martintar Nandi, where the incident happened, the Virgin Australia incident. And since then, there has been an increase in police presence in that area.
Kutika, I just want you give us just a quick recap as we wrap up. Again, the details of Tabuya and when we should expect an outcome for her.
Okay, for Linda Tabuya, the delay on the disciplinary report was due to not gaining enough quorum to sign the report. And that is something that had been highlighted by Prime Minister Sithivani Rambuka last week. And we are expecting to get a result either today or by tomorrow because the extension was due on Friday. So we are just hoping to get it today or tomorrow.
Nice. Look, Kutika, it is great to catch up with you. Really appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
No worries. That, of course, is Kutika Kumar from Fiji's Broadcasting Corporation here on Pacific Beat. To Samoa now, where political tensions between the Prime Minister and the ruling FAST party caused political turmoil. While the past week has been calm, the storm is far from over, especially for the journalists who've been reporting on it. Many have been subject to attack on social media and victims of false information and accusations. So here to share with us more on the situation is head editor of TV1 Samoa News, Rula Suava'i, with NSA Malore Soifun. Welcome to the show, Rula.
Alola Soifua Talofa Lava. Agnes, how are you this morning?
I am great. Thank you very much, Rula. Really, really appreciate your time this morning. All right. And I know the situation has been quite hectic in the last couple of weeks. But before we get into the social media side of things, are you able to just at least update us on the current situation of the political situation there in Samoa?
Yes, Agnes. The political situation is that after last week, we've been expecting something, you know, like a bang from the parliament when it was reconvened for the first time, especially with the political turmoil. However, it looks like things are moving slowly. And what I meant by that is that parliament, you know, progressing well with their continuing on with their government side of things, but the fact remains that there's a faction within one of the political party, and that is the Fatu Tuoletu Samoa Utasi. I remember asking the chairman of the Fatu Tua, the other side, that's Fast 20 as they call it. Remember whether there will be a chance to find a resolution or to consent, you know, Soalaupule to share and to make, patching things up between the political party. But Lauli said that there's no way to amend things. So the situation now is, from what I've seen, is that there's, Fast is going down. So I guess what I'm looking at, and I am predicting, will be a coalition government in the next general election.
Wow, that is
so
a big...
Things are far from patching things up within the political party, yeah.
That's a big call to make, Rula. So, with what happened between the Prime Minister Fiamme and then also Lauli, are we going then to just see this play out publicly or privately?
It could be publicly, it could be privately. Politically speaking, you can't really see what's going on. So, which is sit back and just observe at this point of time.
Sure. Well, you know, the biggest thing that came out of this was, how did social media contribute to what a lot of people were saying online was misinformation and disinformation out there?
Well, exactly. That's exactly what happened, what is happening. There's a lot of misinformation and disinformation out there. And there's a lot of cyberbullying. There's a lot of fake news going on. So what we do here at TV1 is that we don't actually rely on what the people are saying. Or if we do have come across in such an information that needs clarification, we have to make sure that we need an official comment from both sides.
So, you know, when this was happening, we realized that journalists, just like yourself, were covering the story. You were subject to quite a bit of social media attacks. Why do you think this was happening?
It's because of the interpretation and the agenda and how loyal one individual is to one political party. So they tend to manipulate or they tend to change. They tend to spread the misinformation. And that's exactly what I mean. It basically depends on the agenda of a person that is loyal to one particular party.
Rula, what can you share what some of that misinformation or disinformation was put out there?
There's heaps of it. If we narrow down the situation, I may be speaking about myself. I've been, me and my family have been, they've been telling it lots of, we've received a lot of threats, a lot of, and it's, one time I was, you know, the main attack of the people, all from all sorts of, I don't know who they support, but when they do support one another, they tend to attack me on the social media. and it's still continuing. And it gets to the extreme where they actually put up, my children's photos and my husband and one of my families. They even went into ticking what's happening in my family. So that's how danger and how extreme these kind of misinformation have been going. And some sort of misinformation that I realize is that, all of a sudden, everyone become expert in interpreting the law. Everyone. I mean, well, I can't point to anyone particular because I may be, as we speak, they might be putting me up now. But it's very, very bad, and it has a very bad impact on my family and my children as well.
Mm-hmm. Rula, has there been any support then that's been given by the Media Association or to yourself and to other journalists?
Well, in my case, there's nothing. In my case, there was nothing active at this point of time. But I know there were several journalists. One journalist from the Samoa Observer who was heavily attacked. I think the Jaws actually put up a press release. I'm trying to recall because I think there was one time they do. The Jaws is active in, putting up press releases, and they actually advise the local journalists to refrain from contributing or, writing on the social media, by trying to see if which side they prefer or which side political party they do support. So, I might say that the Jaws are actually doing something about it.
Right. Have you personally seen a situation where this has happened previously?
In Samoa?
Yes.
Are you referring to social media?
Yeah. I mean, I asked only because I believe this sort of only really started, this type of attack on journalists and things like that, like when we first had Fia Mea come into power. Is that the case? Do you feel like this was sort of the first time the diaspora had such an influence on what was happening back in Samoa?
Well, actually, there's the diaspora has such an influence of it when there's a change of government. Back in 2021, there's all this sort of all sort of Samoans living overseas, and as well as Samoans living in locally in Samoa, especially those hiding behind the fake pages. They've been using the social media, the Facebook. They've been using it to attack, and from that, like in my case, and that I suddenly have this all sort of different. Names messaging me behind, like giving me threatening words, even my parents, even my family, my children, and that. How can I say it? It's very, very bad. It has a very impact, very, very negative impact on family. Yeah.
So what do you think can be done by authorities and those in charge to help journalists like yourself and others?
I've actually did a story. I actually follow up the police commissioner, but what they can do now is to, give us, what they can do now is to, advising and all that. But they are all also open in, for us to lodge complaint, but make sure that they have lots of evidence to support such issue. So I think the only, the only help that we can get in this kind of situation is the police. It's the police. But then what's really, really hard for the police now is that they are trying to identify. They're also trying to communicate with Facebook authority what they can do so that they can actually identify who's behind the fake pages. Because that is exactly what is happening. All this misinformation and disinformation are from the fake pages on Facebook.
Well, What's your advice then to your reporters and even to others who may be covering this specific story there in Samoa if they encounter online harassment and attacks? What would be your advice to them?
Ignore them. I mean, that's basically what I do. I when I look at it, because I read all of it and I feel that it's not true. So I just, my advice to all the reporters is that use what is fact and make sure that they have solid evidence to back, just like any other reporters. Any stories, yeah.
Of course. Rula, look, we appreciate your time this morning. Unfortunate that it is about, you know, the circumstances of what's been happening. But look, we hope that we get to hear more good news from Samoa in the coming days. But again, Faftaitele, lover, for your time this morning.
Yeah, no worries. Faftaitele, nice meeting you and
Malo lava. That, of course, is head editor of TV1 Samoa News, Rula Suava'ai, here on Pacific Beat.
Newsroom 40, hosted by me, Sam Wikes,
and me, Tenero Aruna. Each week, we'll bring you Pacific Islander stories from on and off the rugby league and rugby union field.
We'll have plenty of special guests, tales from the past, tackle the big topics of today, and look forward to the next-gen Nijan Footy stars.
Nijan Footy. Nijan Footy.
Monday afternoons at 4 o'clock PNG time.
On ABC Radio Australia.
Malo te mai bongbongini, welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Agita Wong. And among the many executive orders that Donald Trump signed during the first days of his second term as US president was one that suspends all of America's foreign assistance programs. The reason? Mr. Trump wants to be sure that those programs align with the values of his administration. However, as Carl Evans reports, a potential setback from some island countries could be an opportunity for Australia to step up in the region.
We will end the Biden-Harris war on American energy, and we will drill, baby, drill. We're going to start that day one.
New U.S. President Donald Trump has wasted little time since re-entering the White House. After withdrawing from the World Health Organization and the Paris Agreement, he's now put a freeze on all U.S. foreign aid programs for 90 days. So what's that mean for the Pacific? Well, to the untrained eye, not a whole lot. Here's Alex Dayant, a researcher at the Lowy Institute.
Over the past kind of decade, they spent around $3 billion in the region. So that's around like 7% of all of the development finance going to the region.
Alex is the author of Lowy's Pacific Aid Map, a database that tracks how aid and development finances flow into the Pacific. Glancing at it, you can see the vast majority of US funding goes toward economic assistance for countries in the North Pacific by way of Compact of Free Association agreements. The remaining 20% gets dispersed elsewhere. Now, it may not seem like a whole lot, but those remaining funds do more than you might think.
Half of this is going to Papua New Guinea, mostly for, you know, health and education. In health, for instance, is like HIV prevention. In education is, you know, like the provision of like support for schools and like renovation of schools. I think, yes, like there is a chance that the US administration might push back a little bit on those kind of initiatives.
Also on the chopping block could be funding for unilateral organizations such as the UN or, as we've already seen, the World Health Organization.
The US contributes 15% of the budget of the WHO, the World Health Organization. And while the WHO doesn't spend that much in the Pacific on a yearly basis, they did play quite a huge role and a very important role during the pandemic. So, you know, withdrawing funding from a region that is probably, you know, like still fighting a little bit with COVID, but also from many other diseases like malaria, like, you know, HIV and all of this, I don't know whether this is, you know, such a great move.
But while Trump might slash funds in some areas, it doesn't mean he can't redirect it to others. Here's Dr. Cameron Hill from the Australian National University's Development Policy Centre.
We could see more of an emphasis on private sector development, which is challenging in the Pacific given some of the country's economic size and structure. And we could also see more of an emphasis on channeling more US aid through faith-based organisations and churches. There'll probably be also more of an emphasis, even more of an emphasis on aid directly linked to America's geopolitical goals in areas like cybersecurity and maritime cooperation.
What's of greater concern is how this shift away from climate change and social and inclusion policies might influence other Pacific Aid donors. Matthew Morey is the acting CEO for the Australian Council for International Development.
I mean, you can look at it two ways. It is true that as one nation steps back, others might step back because they say, well, if they're not going to respond, we're not going to respond. At the same time, it actually is an opportunity for nations like Australia to step up and say, actually, we need to think differently and we can provide some global leadership as we look at the solutions.
Matthew says the 90-day period is an opportunity for Australia to step up and fill those gaps left by the US. If it can do that, Australia could be in prime position to strengthen its relations with Pacific countries.
Having said that, we continue to be concerned that Australia is at a historically low level in terms of its commitment to international development. And while funding to the Pacific has certainly increased over the last few years, and I don't expect that to decline, as an overall quantum, we're at historic lows.
Matthew says Australia commits only 0.68% of its federal budget to foreign aid. He wants to work to see that lifted to 1%.
If you look at what Australia's fair share of it, the commitments it's already made in terms of the commitments it's signed on to globally, Australia's fair share would be something close to $4 billion of a national commitment and growing each year. And Australia is well below that commitment right now.
And that's Matthew Morey, the acting CEO for the Australian Council for International Development, ending that report by Carl Evans.
Join Sosse Fuamoli every Tuesday afternoon for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent, mixed with the sounds and vibe you'll love by artists from across the seas as well. Tune in to Sister Sounds, Tuesday afternoon at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Miss Ulanga, thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat. When Air Vanuatu entered voluntary liquidation in May last year, Australian Airlines stepped in to fill in the gap by providing regular flights. The business and tourism communities were hopeful that the shift marked a new chapter for Vanuatu's aviation sector. But 6 months later, the national carrier was handed back to the government with plans for a reboot. Lucy Cooper has been following developments for Pacific Beat.
Vanuatu resort owner Brendan Dealey believes the collapse of Air Vanuatu was the best thing that's ever happened to the country.
I don't think there was anything holding back the country more than Air Vanuatu.
He says the collapse of the national carrier cost him a significant amount of money.
Air Vanuatu never paid us for a lot of money that they owed us, and we'll never see that money again. We had to house tourists that had no way to get back to Australia, which we ended up doing for so many for free, because Air Vanuatu was meant to pay us and they didn't pay us. But the biggest problem was the opportunity cost. You know, as a country, we got completely downgraded in the market. The opportunity cost for us personally is in the tune of millions. For the country, would be in the tune of probably hundreds of millions.
For years, the airline has been plagued with flight delays and cancellations and operational problems, which led to its collapse in May last year. A report by Air Vanuatu's liquidator Ernst & Young found the airline had been in financial distress, dealing with large debts and unable to pay for spare parts needed to keep its sole Boeing 737 in the air. Under liquidation, Air Vanuatu resumed domestic flights, and when it exited liquidation in October last year, shares of the national carrier were transferred to the shareholders of AV3, a privately owned company of the Vanuatu government. The sole shareholder of AV3 is the Vanuatu Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Previously, the Prime Minister and Ministers of Finance, Trade and Utilities were Air Vanuatu shareholders. Glenn Craig from consultancy group Pacific Advisory says without any new shareholders, the new Air Vanuatu will be tainted.
AV3 and the assets of Air Vanuatu, as far as we're aware, it's the same management, same shareholders, and it's a bit like Groundhog Day. We're going, well, are we really going to go through all of this again?
Matai Seremaia, who was Vanuatu's Deputy Prime Minister at the time he spoke to the ABC, confirmed that under AV3, the airline will continue to fly domestically with plans to re-enter the international market. This worries resort owner Brendan Dealey.
If Air Vanuatu could come back and do domestic flights, that would be absolutely fantastic for the people of Vanuatu. But again, I think there's no space for Air Vanuatu to come back into international because all they'll do is mess up things. It's like you're a little hamburger joint trying to go up against McDonald's. Sometimes you just got to know your place, right? So with all due respect, they don't know how to do it.
Glenn Craig agrees.
If it was just domestic they were looking at, we'd be okay, we'd be supportive, but stay away from international.
He says national pride is the reason for why the government wants to restart international services.
I think that there's several politicians whose parties were involved in the very early days in the formation of Air Vanuatu that took it very personally that Air Vanuatu went broke and can't let it go. And it's nothing more than ego.
George Factafon, an airline consultant who's previously held roles with Air Pacific and the Association of South Pacific Airlines, said a lack of accountability has plagued Air Vanuatu's operations.
I think they're desperately wanting to maintain some form of air transportation. Unfortunately, ego is very expensive.
Air Vanuatu's financial situation was dire when it entered liquidation. It owed more than $99 million to creditors. In the year since, Vanuatu's economic situation has worsened. The deadly magnitude 7.3 earthquake that struck last month left a bill of at least 29 billion Vatu, or 374 million Australian dollars. Glenn Craig says re-entering the international market would only set the government up for huge financial losses.
We're all for the government to sort of retain a silent shareholding, non-management control, you know, 10%, 15%, whatever, so long as it doesn't have any financial obligations for the people of Vanuatu, for the government of Vanuatu, because we've got no funding for this. Hoping that there is a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel in terms of common sense and egos are left at the door and pragmatic business decisions are made around the future of what they're going to do.
So what can be done? Is it possible to improve the aviation situation in Vanuatu? One international organisation believes it has the answer. PANAF Group, a Germany-based airline consultancy company, approached the Vanuatu government after learning of its situation.
We acquire shares of airlines. We help airlines get restructured. We are bringing in managerial expertise into these airlines.
That's PANAF Group board member Oliver Lackman. He says the company has a plan for the entire South Pacific region, bringing national airlines together.
Small island nations' airlines are facing all the same problems. They're too small, they have no scale effect, they're too complex for the size of the airline, which means that it is very hard for them to earn money. We are really thinking about building centers of excellence, which can be used by all of these airlines, which would be potential partners of an alliance.
Mr. Lackman says the airline needs a lot of help, but PANAF Group will provide managerial expertise. Like the government, he too believes that Air Vanuatu should re-enter the international market.
As soon as we have signed a collaboration contract with the government, we are willing to invest into the airline, and that will be in every area. Actually, in quite some interesting talks already to other partners there, which shows us that there's this urgent need to join forces, and that makes it very attractive for us.
Airline consultant George Factafon said whilst centres of excellence aren't a new idea, they are a good one.
It's a good news, the only good news we have so far, and I hope that it can materialise somehow. If they wait for the governments to agree, they could be waiting for a long time. If you've done your due diligence and you think there is some business case that you could go with, then you come and start it.
For resort owner Brendan Dealey, collaboration between airlines, the government and local entrepreneurs is the only way forward.
We'll look back in a generation time, see the people of Vanuatu massively lifted out of poverty and out of all the troubles that they're currently in on the back of tourism.
And that's Vanuatu resort owner Brendan Dealey ending that report from Lucy Cooper.
Hold the front page!
Vina Kavakalevu, welcome back to Pacific Beat. We are joined in the studio live this Monday morning with our producer, Fina Fonua. You're back!
Yes, I'm back.
Did you have a nice little break?
Yes.
Well rested.
Good sleeping in, yeah.
Must be nice. Appreciate you coming in this morning to do our news wrap. I believe there's a little bit of drama in Samoa last Friday. One police officer was reportedly shot in a hostage situation. Can you tell us more?
Yes. According to Samoan Observer, a 46-year-old man is in police custody following a tense and frightening confrontation with law enforcement on Friday afternoon, during which that man shot at three police officers. He's a Chinese expat, and he's been formally charged, of course, with multiple offences apart from attempted murder. That includes unlawful possession of firearm. The incident unfolded when police responded to a call about a domestic dispute at the man's residence, where he operates a business. According to police, the dispute involved the man and his ex-wife. When officers arrived on the scene, the situation rapidly escalated, and the man fired upon the police, injuring one of them. And the situation grew more tense. The man barricaded himself inside his home, holding his ex-wife hostage at gunpoint. But eventually, after hours of negotiations, the man surrendered to police. There were no injuries.
Wow. Okay, well, thank you for that story. We head to Tonga, though, because the new Prime Minister, Honourable Dr. Aisake Varu'eke, has met with Pacific Islands Forum Chair Baron Wonga. What's the details there?
Yes, Matangi Tonga Online reports the newly sworn Prime Minister, Dr. Eke, will pick up Tonga's leadership role as Pacific Islands Forum Chair. As you know, the former Prime Minister, Hokawa Meiliko, stepped down from his position. And he was meant to, he had been appointed to be chair of the Pacific Islands Forum. Dr. Eke will take up that position now. He'll chair pivotal ministerial meetings this year, including the special forum economic ministers meeting, the forum trade ministers meeting, and the forum foreign ministers meeting as well.
Sure. Okay. Look, I do want to end off on this one, though, Finau. We're hearing reports that New Zealand's Foreign Affairs Secretary is in the Cook Islands to discuss this proposed Cook Islands passport.
Yeah, that's right. New Zealand's Foreign Affairs and Trade Secretary, Mr. Corey, is in Rarotonga. The Cook Islands Foreign Affairs Office said Corey's visit to Rarotonga will be the first. He'll be the first official visit. His first official visit to the country this year. The proposed Cook Islands passport will be one of the issues discussed with the Cook Islands government. This is according to Cook Islands News. Prime Minister Mark Brown earlier this month called on Cook Islanders not to be anxious about discussions that they may have regarding the proposal. Cook Islanders are concerned it may affect their rights in regards to New Zealand. But he said that they'll retain their New Zealand citizenship. That's part of the proposal. Foreign Minister Winston Peters said that the Cook Islands can only have its own passport if it is fully independent.
Nice. Finau, look, I appreciate your time bringing us the news wrap here on Pacific Beat. If you've just tuned in, that's our producer, and that's your news wrap here on Pacific Beat.
Pacific Beat.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. One in two people in the Pacific Islands with a body mass index of 30 plus is classified as overweight or obese. And while various factors contribute to obesity, limited access to clean drinking water plays an overlooked role. So without safe drinking water supplies, sugary drinks can be seen as an alternative and increase the risk of obesity. There's new research that explores how water insecurity in the Pacific Island nation of Kiribati correlates with sugary drink consumption. So joining us this morning to discuss more of this matter is Senior Research Fellow of Applied Microeconomics at the University of Sydney and co-author of the Water Insecurity Research, Suniha Sitahol. With that, I say welcome to the show, Suniha.
Thank you, Agnes. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, appreciate your time this morning. This is a really fascinating type of research that, like I said in the intro, is something that we've sort of overlooked in regards to water consumption versus sugary consumption. I do want to start with water insecurity, though. Can you maybe explain how this was defined through your research?
Yes. So a lot of households in the Pacific Islands in general lack access to safe drinking water. And in our study, we looked at the specific case of Kiribati. And using existing data, which is household survey data, we found that a lot of households did not have access to safe drinking water. That means they did not have a piped water system in their house. And they relied mostly on rainwater tanks, unprotected groundwater, or protected wells.
So then, did anything really surprise you about Kiribati's situation, maybe versus any of the other Pacific Islands?
So there is a general consensus that the fact that many Pacific Islands face these issues. So it's not particularly surprising per se. However, there is a lack of data to exactly track how many households lack access to safe drinking water, which is why we focus on the case of Kiribati. So I would say no, it's not particularly surprising, but definitely something to focus on.
Yeah, because you were saying that, you know, that they don't have much access to a safe, I suppose, water system. Are we talking about groundwater, rainwater, or is this more of like a imported bottled water consumption?
So most households, around 60% of them, use rainwater and groundwater. And so this is what we mean when we say unsafe drinking water, because they're more likely to be contaminated and have things like bacteria in them. And so then that means that the remaining households that drink safe drinking water have a piped water system in their house. And a very small share of households also drink bottled water. But this is not a large share of households. Right. It's only a few percentage of them.
Which then obviously led to your research saying that if there is no proper access to water, that you know, those in Kiribati are turning more to sugary drinks. What type of sugary drinks are we seeing in the Pacific?
So in the data that we use, we define sugary drinks as soft and sweet beverages. So these can be soft drinks, that are commonly known everywhere, but also things like syrups that people mix with water. So these are the types of drinks we're talking about, and also some types of juices. So all of these drinks basically have a very high level of calories and a low nutritional value.
Which you are then seeing contributing to the level of obesity. Is that correct?
So, yes, there's an extensive body of research that shows that consuming more of these sugary drinks is linked to higher body weight. This is the hypothesis that we base our study on.
Which is really interesting, though, sitting here, because, you know, traditionally, we from the islands, we live on a land that's, you know, supplied with fresh fish. We've got veggies, we've got local fruits. So are you seeing some type of upward trend of sugary drinks and processed food taking over?
So, yes. And this is one issue that is seen globally. With globalization, there is a shift in dietary trends, where people rely more on processed foods, often through imports, which changes traditional diets and leads to more intake of these types of foods, such as sugary drinks, and therefore higher body weights.
Is it then maybe a matter of discontinuing, like, the importation of these drinks, or I would think maybe taxing sugary drinks so that there is a lesser consumption of it?
So there are many policy avenues here. And so this study shows that it's not just about the sugary drinks, it's also about access to clean water. So the main policy recommendation from our study would be to increase access to safe drinking water. But as you mentioned, taxing sugary drinks is also one policy avenue, which in many cases have proven effective. For example, in Mexico, there are studies that show that increasing taxes on sugary drinks led to a significant decline in their consumption.
And then overall, what are some interventions then that really need to be put in place so that not just Kiribati, but the rest of the Pacific region may learn from this to have better access to water?
So at local levels, there needs to be important investments in allowing households to access clean drinking water. So this can mean providing households with things like tank kits and filters so that the people who are drinking groundwater or rainwater at least have safe options. Other more broader agendas would be to invest in research and technologies of seawater desalination plants, namely ones that rely on clean energy sources. And this can not only benefit one given country, but the region in general.
And so then overall, what are you saying that, you know, that we could learn today? What's our listeners needing to know about sugary drink consumption versus the safer access to water?
So overall, if households had better access to clean drinking water, they would substitute less by drinking sugary drinks. This would benefit their health by avoiding them issues such as diabetes, heart disease, but also in general, access to drinking water has been linked to many other types of diseases, especially in infants, such as diarrhea, etc. So there is an overall general benefit to investing in safe drinking water for households at both ends of the weight spectrum. So for lower weight individual and higher weights.
Well, this is definitely a conversation that needs to be continued, and we love that you're doing this type of research, Saniha, and we do appreciate your time this morning. Thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you, Agnes. Thanks for having me.
That is Saniha Sitahol, Senior Research Fellow at the Applied Microeconomics at the University of Sydney here on Pacific Beat. Well, that literally brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Time to take a look back at one of our main stories today. Among the many executive orders that newly sworn US President Donald Trump has signed is the suspension of all American foreign assistance programs.
I think, yes, like there is a chance that the US administration might push back a little bit on those kind of initiatives.
I'll be back same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time, but you can hear us this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. Coming up after that, it's Nisha Daily. Until next time, o tua o whaato, this is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.